Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back to The Mark Steiner Show. Today, we're going to examine some of the cultural offerings in this city that you can enjoy this month and next. We're going to start with a conversation with the folks from Everyman Theater, who are currently putting on an amazing performance of Anton Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard. And then we'll begin our series of profiles of films you can see during the Maryland Film Festival, which begins on May the 7th. We'll speak with Judy Richardson, filmmaker who made the chilling documentary Scarred Justice, The Orangeburg Massacre, 1968. This is a story of an event where police opened fire on black students, killing three and injuring at least 28. It happened 2 years before Kent State. And though that moment is burned into our national consciousness, no one seems to know about the Orangeburg Massacre. That's coming up in the second half of the hour. But first, let's learn about a great new theater production happening right now in our city. There are two major theaters in town that are theaters that use union actors in the city, that put on professional productions with professional actors who are paid for a living. And one of those two theaters is here today, and that's the Everyman Theater, founded and whose artistic director and founder is Vince Lancisi. They are doing a new production of an old production of The Cherry Orchard by Anton Chekhov. And Vincent Lancisi is with us, along with Deborah Hazlett, who is one of the actors in that production. And welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank
Great
you.
To be here.
Everyman's a Theater sits right next, hard up against the Charles Theater in North Baltimore. You created an equity theater in this town. The other one being Center Stage, you created one. How many years has it been now?
Our first show was 1990.
People have said it was impossible to create a new theater in the city, an equity theater. Now you've been around since 1990, and you've just done the second impossible thing, which was raise enough money to build a new theater right near the Hippodrome.
I know. It's so exciting. We can't wait
to
get
down
there.
It's an amazing feat you've done here for the city. And for yourself and for theater.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm living a dream, Mark. This is a dream. I'm not kidding. You know, when we first came, I went fresh out of grad school, moved to Baltimore just to start this professional theater company. And it had to be a resident company. I wanted local artists, professionally trained. I wanted ensemble theater at its best. And I remember the first thing that someone said to me was, well, why does Baltimore need another theater? We have Center Stage. You know, right. Washington has 32 professional theaters. Isn't that amazing? 32. It's like going to Broadway and saying, well, why do we need another theater?
Right.
We've got all these other ones. It's just so gratifying to know that, you know, when theaters across the country are losing subscription audiences, the audiences are dwindling, especially the ones that will commit to all the shows in the season, that Everyman continues to grow our subscribers every year. It just, I want to knock on every piece of wood I can find. We're so grateful for our audience. We have over about 4,500 subscribers now.
Wow.
It's incredible.
Wow. And Dave Hazlett, you've been almost from the beginning. For a long time, you've been in this theater.
Well, not from the beginning, but
I
did my first show for Vinny in, it was either 97 or 98. Now I can't remember. When was Cat?
Yeah, 97.
97. And then about a year later, was invited to join the company. So it's been my home for a long time. And believe me, in this business, having a theatrical home, an artistic home, and also an artistic family is most rare and most welcome.
But that's the difference here. As you were just saying, and you were just talking about, Deb, is that, and you were saying, Vinny, that it's a resident theater, which is really a very different animal than the Center Stage, not putting it down, but Center Stage being that jobs in people from all over the country and mostly New York, I would say. It's hard for a Baltimore actor, a D.C. actor, to get a job at Center Stage, but very difficult. But what you've done is create the kind of, is bring a resident theater, which describe that for our listeners in terms of what that means.
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, it's an aesthetic choice. To me, the actor's at the center of all theater. You know, you have great scripts, bad scripts. You have beautiful sets. You have no sets. Two great actors standing on a stage talking to each other creates theater. So all the work that we do at Everyman is always right focused on the actors. And I just feel like, you know, throughout history, actors have had to leave their communities and move to New York or to L.A. or to Chicago to make their living. And we don't require that of many, many, many other professions. So when there's this great wealth of talent in the Baltimore-Washington region, and it's immense. Some argue it's the third largest talent pool in the country.
After?
after
Chicago,
so
New
it's
York.
New York, LA, Mid-Atlantic, Chicago, if you incorporate Baltimore,
right.
DC area.
Right.
Because there's, you know, as I said before, 32 professional theaters in DC. You've got all the industrial films that are being made and a lot of commercial films being made in Baltimore and Washington. And there's a lot of work for actors, especially if they switch mediums and can cobble together a living there. But my big concern was, I was weaned on theaters like Trinity Repertory Theater in Providence and then Arena Stage in Washington in their heydays when they had resident companies that had, you know, 20, 30 actors that were performing in rotating repertory all season long. And for me, there's a whole extra layer of aesthetic enjoyment of getting to see how this particular actor is going to tackle this particular role as compared to the role that he played in the previous. So, you know, in Arena, it wasn't at all unusual to see a company member playing Hamlet one minute and then the next minute playing a very small supporting role
right.
in a comedy. And delightful. Sometimes you don't even figure out until three quarters of the way through the play who that is. And what it does on stage is actors, as they get to know each other, you know, most people don't realize that in theater, actors come together, often meeting for the first time in the beginning of rehearsals. And in 4 weeks, they have to create the illusion of a lifelong marriage or, you know, in-depth relationships. So they have to be able to get to the nub of those relationships in a very brief period of time. And then they go away and they may not work again for 10 years or may never work again.
Together.
Right. But then you've got, you know, company members who have been with each other, you know, working with each other for 10 years. And all they have to do is glance at each other in a funny way and they know something's wrong. Or they're on point all the time. They don't have to have a whole conversation about a particular moment. They recognize it and it enhances their work on stage. Our audiences benefit from that over and over again, whether they know it or not, because the performances get richer and richer because we don't have to talk about it all the time.
And it's also a very intimate setting.
Yeah.
The theater's very intimate. We're talking with Vincent Lancisi, who's artistic director and founder of Everyman Theater, director of this latest production of The Cherry Orchard by Anton Chekhov. Deborah Hazlett's with us, who is one of the most wonderful actors in our community and is in this play. And they're both in the studio with us now to talk about this production, which runs from March the 18th. Which best is already, that's in the past. But it's to the future, April 26th is where it runs to. So we've done with March 18th, but now we're moving ahead. So that's what happens when you read instead of think. So
it's all those lost opportunities, Mark. All those performances that have gone by, we can never get them. But fortunately, we have a couple of weeks more.
We have a couple of weeks left.
Yes.
Which is one of the reasons we're doing this. To get people out to the theater, and we'll tell you how to do that towards the end of our conversation. So let's talk about this production and The Cherry Orchard. I mean, it is Chekhov, which you two can describe for our listeners, for folks who are not familiar with Anton Chekhov's work, one of the great playwrights of all time. This was his last play. Some say very reflective of his early childhood, or his earlier life.
To me, Chekhov he's the master playwright of the modern age. I mean, he actually is the man who made a lot of what we're used to seeing in terms of styles of acting and in film today and in theater today. Because before him, you know, all theater was about text and melodramatic text, you know.
Very melodramatic.
Oh, my God, you know, very straight up, you know, it was either a thriller or a comedy or, you know,
it was very proclamatory. It was like,
yeah,
right.
Awful.
That's a great word to describe it.
Proclamatory.
Right.
Proclamatory, yeah. So then along comes Chekhov.
Or declamatory.
Right.
And here comes Chekhov, and he writes these plays that are so recognizable to real life. They're so both slice of life realism, but at the same time, he was smart enough as a dramatist to expand those moments, those recognizable moments, the thought, the sigh, the subtext. It's not, you know, he sort of figured out that we rarely say what we mean. In fact, if we did, there'd be no drama. But he figured out that there's all this subtext laying underneath that make us feel a certain way in that particular moment, and that it can turn on a dime. We can be absolutely devastated by something and be crying hysterically, and something funny happens. You know, that funny thing that all of a sudden the tears turn to laughter, and it seems bizarre, but it's absolutely real. There are moments through this play over and over again where you break out laughing in the midst of very sad story, you know.
Well, that's really interesting about this particular play, The Cherry Orchard, and it just if you want to kind of describe this play and where it's set, because when you just talked about laughter and weeping, I want to come to that, because that's kind of the uniqueness of this play having over the last 100-odd years trying to define itself. Which one is it going to be? Are you a comedy or are you a tragedy? Right. So we could talk about that in a minute, but talk a bit about this play from your perspective, Deb, and what this play is about.
Well, and it is both a comedy and a tragedy, because that's what life is, and that's what Chekhov, I think, really got at. And Chekhov is not really plot-driven. It's really not. It's really character-driven.
The main event of this play happens off stage.
That's right.
Right.
And so
why
actors love it is because it's really about finding a way to make these characters really three-dimensional, very much real people. And the reason it's funny and sad at the same time is because we are, and life is. And, you know, you're always in trouble if somebody says, or if you say about yourself, oh, my character wouldn't do that.
Right.
No, actually, your character probably would, because we tend to read on the page and try to get a linear sort of one-dimensional idea about how a character behaves. But Chekhov won't let you do that, because the moment you have a moment of great introspection or sadness, you turn around and say something literally that is the opposite of what you've just reflected. So you have to make turns quickly, and you have to be willing to do it and leap into it. And people are funny. And even in the midst of something sad happening to them, people are funny.
Right.
And that's
resilient.
Yeah. You know, you do turn on we turn on a dime in life. So, of course, Chekhov's characters are going to be able to do it. And as an actor, you have to just not be afraid of it. And you have to not worry, which we talked about early on. And Vinny's one of the things I love about the way Vinny directs is, I think one of the very first things Vinny said to me is, don't worry about whether or not people like your character. Worry about whether they understand it. So it's not about being a particularly likable character. It's about being clear and specific so people know why you behave the way you behave. And that's what invites catharsis, and that's what invites connection, is a recognition of self maybe in the character, maybe when they're not behaving in the best way, but a recognition of truth. And he really pushes for that in rehearsal. He really does.
You know, when you talk about this play in terms of what it's about, I mean, I think that one of the reasons we love working on the reason that it's a classic is that Chekhov was so specific about the time and place and unique circumstances that these people were living under. Now, let's talk about it. So we have aristocrats that own a big, beautiful estate on a magnificent cherry orchard, one of the most beautiful places your eye would ever go. I mean, think Washington when the cherry blossoms are in bloom, except there's only one house, and it's yours.
Right. It's an entire forest of cherry orchards in bloom
when the play opens, and they're in this magnificent estate. The aristocrats—
In Russia.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what time are we talking about? Aristocrats are overextended. They have been living on credit for generations. They have a huge, massive shift in the political landscape. 12 years before, the serfs were freed. The slaves were set free, and a new merchant class arises. The old aristocrats, stuck in their old ways, don't really know how to survive in this landscape. And because they can't pay their debts, their land is going to be auctioned. And they all come together in this home to try to find a way to keep the house from being auctioned. But they have absolutely no skills in this area. They don't know how to handle the changing tides. They don't know how to stave off the new merchant class, and so there is an old friend of the family, in fact, a son of a serf who's now rich. 10 years later, he's made a lot of money for himself, and he gives them a way out, tells them all the way through the first two acts of the play, which takes place over 4 or 5 months, I have the solution. You have to sell the estate. You have to sell it and parcel out the land. knock down the cherry trees, knock down the estate,
build cottages
for the new summer countrymen, that new class of people that will come and buy, you know, these plots and build their houses. But the aristocrats can't hear it. It's so vulgar to them, you know, and it's so not real, and it's not a solution. And so the auction comes, and who buys the house? A former serf. It's absolutely earth-shattering, because really Chekhov was ahead of his time, because it's some years before the actual Russian Revolution. But he understood the change was coming, and that it was all about who's going to survive, who's going to adapt, who's going to thrive in the New World Order. And I think he felt that change was not a bad thing. So much so that when they first produced the play, and Stanislavski and his company of actors saw this play as this incredible tragedy of the death of the aristocracy.
The Moscow Art Theater.
Right, Moscow Art Theater, who created a whole new school of acting to deal with Chekhov's plays. Audiences bursting into tears as Stanislavski, the strongest actor, male actor, takes on the role of Gayev, an aristocrat. Okay, and Chekhov's wife, Olga Knipper, an amazing actress, takes on the role of the other aristocrat, his sister, who Deb plays in this.
Luba.
Luba. You know, and so the whole focus in that production was this incredible loss.
So here comes Chekhov on the train. You have got to stop making this a tragedy.
You're ruining
my play.
It's a comedy, for God's sake. You know? It's a comedy. I'm sorry. At the end of the play, they're saying goodbye to the estate that their great-grandfathers grew up on with the tears coming down. How can you not cry at that? Well, I don't think Chekhov meant comedy in the way
right.
that we think of comedies, but he had a point. He had a point, because for him, it was about this actually is a happy ending, because many of these people, especially the young ones and the merchants who bought the estate where his grandfather was a slave, are going to move into this new. They're going to change and adapt and prosper in this new, if they can make the change. The old servant, the fears, the 90-year-old. Servant who's been with them forever, he can't change. He wasn't happy for the emancipation of the serfs. He actually says in the play, he said, you know, you knew where you stood. You know, there were masters and there were servants, and I always
he says the masters belong, the servants belong to the masters, and the masters belong to the servants.
Interesting. And this young former serf that is now a merchant and a millionaire looks at him like he's got 16 heads. He says, yeah, it was good. At least they flogged you back then. You know, it's so different, the perspective, that you understand what Chekhov means when he, you know, when you look at the young people in the play, when you look at the survivors, and I think that's why he has fears the old servant get locked into the house and die in the end. I mean, it's because he can't make that change. He can't.
And you want to say something, Deb?
Well, I just am so fascinated with the way Chekhov understands the transition between the old and the new. And these young, Trofimov, the young student who's played by Clint Van Hagen, he's lovely. And the way he talks about the new world coming and the way the aristocrats can't really hear it. And yet, when he and I have a confrontation in the play, there's this wonderful, wonderful, it's my favorite part of the play, wonderful language, where Luba says to him...
Can you do that little piece for us? It might be difficult.
No, I can. It might not be. She says, you know, he says, you have to open your eyes. You're blind. You're not seeing the truth. And she says, yes, but what truth? You see which is truth and which is falsehood. But I feel as if I've gone blind. I can't see anything at all. You boldly settle all the great questions. But my love, isn't that because you're young? Isn't that because you've never had to live a single one of those questions out? You look boldly forward, but isn't that because you have the eyes of youth, so that life is still hidden from them, so that you see nothing frightening in store? And it's this beautiful, it's one of my favorite moments in the play, because it's so true
mm-hmm.
that this youthful exuberance about, you know, be daring and be deep and be honest, juxtaposed with a woman who has suffered great loss. She's lost a child. He drowned in the river
right.
when he was 7 years old. Her husband died a month before that. Juxtaposing those life experiences in such a real three-dimensional way is what Chekhov just, it's where it lifts. And yet at the end, it's comedic when he storms out and says, everything is over between us. And she says, oh, you're being absurd. I was just joking. And when the laughs come from the audience, when they really understand the absurdity and the laughs come, it's such a relief to us because there's a lot of funny stuff in this, in that people are behaving in a really absurd way. And sometimes I think the audiences are afraid to laugh at how absurd it is, because there's also some real grief in the play. But the moments of levity with lovely Owen, who plays Yeppe Hodov, he's just lovely. Oh, so many lovely actors, and Will and Carl and everyone. But the comedy is there, and it's throughout.
You know, one of the older aristocrats is played by Will Love, who's one of the best comic actors in this region, I can imagine. Is an old aristocrat who's so decadent, you know, that they're having tea and it's late at night and he's eating all these tea sandwiches and they're drinking coffee and he falls asleep in the middle of a sentence and then he wakes up and picks up his next line, you know, and the audience just falls out of their chair. And of course, it's in a nursery, so they're all sitting at a child's table with children's, and they're in their 60s, two of them, and they're trying to get down to the chair without falling onto the floor. And there's just loads of humor that we all sort of recognize.
Well, and the company issue that I just wanted to speak to, the
acting
beautiful
company.
What the result of that, which Vinny also spoke to, is an actor. When I look at Megan Anderson-Prue across the stage, we've done many shows together. She's played my sister twice. There is a look between us around something that can just lift a moment. And the audience sees it because people talk about it. The reality of our actual relationships with people that are in the company, Rosemary, Carl, it gives a level of performance that and I work out of town a lot in different states and different theaters, and you sometimes have 4 weeks, but often these days you have 3 weeks of rehearsal. So those things you create because it's your job, so you create the relationships, but with a company you have them, and you get to it just enriches the performance in a way that is a dream come true.
And this particular play, it is a very powerful play. It's a very funny play. It's a very emotional play. There's the subtext here of romance and intrigue that goes on inside of this as well, and generational, as you said, between classes, and even Chekhov's deep love for the woods himself. Mm-hmm. And he was in love with.
Oh yeah, nature was his thing, and he was a doctor, and he just spent an inordinate amount of time in the very poor countrysides doing a lot of work in clinics and administering to rural people. Who had no money to pay. He loved all of that. He also he grew up in a cherry orchard. And when he wrote this play, he was very sick. He died 6 months later.
1904 is when this production was, right?
That's right. That's right. So he had a lot of feelings about the intelligentsia, who would talk and never do anything. You know, you know, Mark, there's a passage that the young teacher Trofimov has where he's railing against the intelligentsia, of which he's a part. That's right. The irony, which makes the speech both passionate and funny at the same time. But he says, you know, where are the reading rooms? Where are the day nurseries that we've been talking about for years? And you suddenly think to yourself, my God, you know, I think I just heard a radio show where they were saying, where are the daycare centers? How do we afford them? You know, what about the cuts to the library? They're going to be shut, you know, a day a week or shorter hours. Or these issues, you know, a century later across the sea, right? It's so prescient. It's unbelievable.
This play, The Cherry Orchard, I was thinking about this this afternoon on my way back to meet you all, that it's very relevant for 2009. I mean, it fits our world today. And even the human subtext doesn't change from whether it's 1904 or 2009. It's the same human interactions that happen no matter where you are.
We feel it at night too.
Oh my God, the audience has collective gasps of recognition, you
know? And it's that's the thing that makes doing this work worth it and makes me feel it is worthwhile is when you have that kind of connection with an audience. But it's very hard to lose a home on stage and lose a way of life and realize that there are people possibly watching that are going through that.
Right.
But what it creates in us, I hope, as a company, is that we want to be very respectful about how we manage the material and to be very aware of that so that we reach those people with respect and love, that we know that there are people in our country that are suffering the things that the characters mm-hmm. are suffering all these years ago in Russia.
We're talking about a production of The Cherry Orchard. They'll be running from now until April the 26th at Everyman Theater. This is a very special production and a very special theater. The director, Vince Nancisi, is with us, of course, founder of Everyman Theater. Deb Hazlett, one of the wonderful actors who's been in this community and been in this theater for a long time, joins us. She plays Luba in this production. And it runs through April the 26th. And for the price of a movie, you can take you and somebody you care about to see a production that is better than a movie and really enjoy the evening. You can call 410-752-2208, 410-752-2208, or go to everymantheater.org, and that's theater with an R-E at the end, .org, to get your tickets. And it runs from, how many nights a week is it? From
We're five nights a week,
five nights a week. So that starts on Wednesday?
Yep, Wednesdays and Thursday nights, Friday nights, two shows Saturday, two shows Sunday.
Do not miss this production of Cherry Orchard, and you may never go back to a movie again. Good to see you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
It's been great. Don't go away. After this break, we're going to hear from filmmaker Judy Richardson. She's the director of a new chilling documentary called Scarred Justice, The Orangeburg Massacre, 1968. This is the story of an event where police opened fire on black students, killing three and injuring at least 28. It happened 2 years before Kent State. But though that moment is burned into our national consciousness, no one seems to know about the Orangeburg Massacre. We'll hear that story when we come back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're going to talk now with Judy Richardson, senior producer at Northern Light Productions. An old civil rights warrior from SNCC and more, which we'll get into. They produced this incredible documentary that will be showing at the Maryland Film Festival called Scarred Justice, The Orangeburg Massacre, 1968. And Judy Richardson, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Mark, for having me.
So this is a moment in our history, Judy Richardson, that is completely forgotten. It was forgotten then. And it's forgotten now. Talk about how you, a bit about the history of this and how you came to it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, just in terms of what it was, because most people really do not know. I know you know because mm-hmm. you were an activist back then, but most people don't even know that this ever happened. It's the first time that that police opened fire on an American campus. It happened 2 years before Kent State. It's 1968. And the students of two historically black colleges in Orangeburg, South Carolina, Claflin University and South Carolina State, they had been protesting over a period of a couple of days the segregation, wasn't even segregation, a bowling alley that had a whites-only policy. And it was a bowling alley that was only 5 minutes from both colleges, two historically black colleges. And so over the period of 4 days, it kind of, things escalate. The students are basically locked down on campus, and this is Thursday night, February 8th, 1968. And so at sometime in the night, they build a bonfire, you know, as students will. And they're building a bonfire, and they're singing songs and freedom songs. And you hear in our interviews, you hear the young people then talk about it. And they're also shouting, you know, nasty things at the police. But at that point, you had 450 armed police in the town of Orangeburg. You had a number, about 120, that are lined up in front of the, right in the area of the South Carolina State, which is where the bonfire was. They put the bonfire out, and then somewhere around 10:30 p.m., they don't know who gave the order or if an order was given, but shots opened fire from the state police, and at the end of those firing, of about, they think about 8 seconds. Three of the students are killed, and about at least 28 are wounded.
Right.
And so then they start rushing them to the segregated hospital. A number are rushed to Columbia, so we don't really know whether it was only 28. Because they know that it's a segregated hospital in Orangeburg, so they go to Columbia. Some of the faculty at South Carolina State rush them to the hospital. So this only really comes to light because of two white Southern journalists, Jack Bass and Jack Nelson, in terms of trying to really bring this to a more national understanding. And Jack Nelson, who was then the Washington bureau chief of the Los Angeles Times, goes in, and he's from the L.A. Times Washington Bureau. So he says to the hospital staff, well, I'd like to see who was shot. I'm from the Bureau. And they say, well, you know, we can't really do that. And he says, well, cover it because of privacy issues. And he says, well, just cover it up. Cover up the name. And so what he finds is that all of those students were shot either in the back or in the side as they were fleeing on their own campus. But the reason that it doesn't get out is because of how the state of South Carolina and then-Governor McNair frames the incident. And they say immediately the students were charging at the police, and meaning the state highway police, and that they were shooting at them, and so that the law enforcement were only protecting themselves. Now, of course, the FBI subsequently finds that there were no shots. There was no evidence of any shots being fired from campus. But in any event, the only thing that happens is they have a trial of the police officers. All of them are set for. I mean, they are never convicted. Even though Attorney General Ramsey Clark at the time, he is U.S. Attorney General, he immediately orders an investigation because he says there has been a clear abuse of power. However, he can't get any South Carolina grand jury to indict. When they go to trial, he can't get a conviction of the police. And the only person ever convicted of anything is Cleveland Sellers, who had just returned from having worked with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, in the South, in Mississippi and Alabama, doing voter registration work. He comes back to his hometown of Orangeburg because he grew up 15 minutes away in Denmark. They call him an outside agitator. His thing is, I don't even want to, he's trying to build black consciousness groups on the campuses of University of South Carolina and the two black campuses. His mother had gone to South Carolina State, so he knew the area. But his thing is, he's trying to build black consciousness groups to talk about the history and the responsibility of black colleges. And meanwhile, some other students are trying to do this, integrating a bowling alley. And his thing is, that's not important. But he is the one who is put on trial. And he is the one who gets 7 months. And he is the one who it takes 24 years to get a pardon for. And then he becomes chairman of, I'm giving away the story. I'm hoping people see the film.
Well, they will see the film. Let's talk a bit about that. I mean, you open this film, and we can piece some of this together because I think it's important for people to hear it. I mean, it's,
okay.
I mean, even in the 60s, with all the tumult and the revolution in the streets and organizing going on in the 60s in America against the war and against racism and where all this began. You have Kent State University, where four students were shot down by the National Guard and made famous by the song Four Dead in Ohio, and everybody kind of, it changed the nature of campuses in the anti-war movement because of that killing, those killings. But here we have, before that, and before any of the killings at Mississippi State, the Orangeburg Massacre in 1968, where three black students were killed and at least 28 more shot in the back and the side by National Guardsmen and State Police of South Carolina. And nobody, A, remembers it now, but even then, it was swept under the rug and nobody talked about it, and it was just put down as just another black rebellion, and we had to put these people down. And it was forgotten.
That's right. Because of the way that the state of South Carolina is allowed to frame it. Because it is. You are absolutely right. The people, I think, forget how frightened folks were both black, some black people and certainly the white community was afraid because they saw black power, which had just been uttered 2 years before, as violent. And of course, when SNCC, you know, talks about black power, they don't think it's going to be any kind of, you know, revelation, because that's what we had been doing all this time, you know, trying to create a sense of power within the African-American community at a number of levels so that we could come to the table with some sense of power that people would have to listen to in the same way every other community had done it, you know. Mm-hmm. So we don't understand why this humongous reaction against this call for now what we're saying is black power, okay? So it's 2 years after that call, and people are thinking, oh, this means violence. That has nothing to do with what we were talking about. However, they are allowed to do that, and, of course, the rebellions are going on in the cities. We have somebody in the film who says, you know, what they were worried about was, is, you know, Detroit going to come to Orangeburg? You know, so they locked down the students right after, during the demonstrations, the night of the massacre. They have cordoned them off because, as one of our interviewees says, the white administration in Orangeburg is afraid these folks are going to come and poison the water supply. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really that serious. They're going to, you know, it's, I mean, part of it is the, you know, old slave rebellion kind of mentality, and particularly this is South Carolina. So, you know, you get that, you know, the horde, the black hordes are going to come and, you know, overwhelm us. So that is what is operative. And because the state of South Carolina is at that time seen as a more moderate
state. The governor was seen as more moderate.
Yeah, right. In the context of Mississippi and Alabama. You know, they don't have Bull Connor doing hoses then. And Governor McNair at that time was slated to be the vice presidential nominee for Humphrey, who they thought was going to win the Democratic nomination.
Right.
So, and he loses his chance because of this and does not realize it until the night of the Democratic convention, when he goes and thinks that he's going to get the nomination, and only finds out like an hour before he goes to the convention that he's not being put up as the VP nominee because he thinks he's done the right thing. He thinks, because white people in South Carolina think this, that he has done this wonderful thing protecting the white community from these marauding black hordes.
And it, what's amazing, this also is described in the very beginning of the film, Orangeburg, South Carolina is an area where blacks were in a majority and whites were a minority, even though whites ran it, which is it was pretty remarkable. And the strength of the black community in that area, standing up in the face of that, was pretty amazing.
It was. And the thing is, they had a history of protest. I mean, the black community had done boycotts around segregated facilities. The two schools, the students from there, had done a number of demonstrations in the early 60s. There had been major demonstrations in Rock Hill, South Carolina, earlier in the 60s. But it's also good to understand that this is not just a Southern attitude. Because I was reading this thing, they had this wonderful chart in the Times, December 20th of last year, and they talked about the way we were 1968. And right. They have a section called White Views of Negroes, and this is national. And they said 67% of whites believe that Negroes, as they say, are asking for more than they are ready for. 63% nationally think that Negroes have less ambition than whites. 44% think that Negroes have less native intelligence than whites. Mm-hmm. This is a national sense of the black community. So that's the other reason that when the state of South Carolina puts this thing out, you know, they're charging, they have the guns, that people believe them. Now, the New York Times does good coverage, but then that drops away. And certainly the L.A. Times does wonderful coverage because of Jack Bass. And the Charlotte News and Observer does good coverage because, I'm sorry, Jack Nelson, the L.A. Times, right. And then Jack Bass because of the North Carolina News and Observer, where he's the bureau chief. But other than that, nobody's doing it. And the initial report that goes out is from the AP, which then, of course, sent to all the national newspapers. And that first report says that the students were shooting. Now, the photographer who sent in the report says himself, I did not say that. I never saw anybody shooting. But it never gets corrected.
It in this film that you've produced, and by the way, we're talking Judy Richardson. The film we're talking about is a documentary called Scarred Justice, The Orangeburg Massacre, 1968, a little-known piece of our modern American history that was very profound at that moment. And it will be revealed in this film, and you can all see it at the Maryland Film Festival over the weekend of May the 7th. We'll tell you more about that later, where it will be featured in the film festival, for which the Mark Steiner Show is a media partner. Yes, absolutely. and we're talking to its senior producer from Northern Light Productions, Judy Richardson, at this moment. In the film, I mean, what comes out in this film also is that the FBI cover-up, the role that the police played in covering this up, I mean, the lies that were told, and those lies directly affecting the life of Cleveland Sellers, SNCC activist who came back to his home, as you talked about earlier, in Orangeburg, North Carolina, and was convicted and put in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And railroaded. I mean, this was so emblematic of what really happened in that period of time that people just don't realize how many people in this country were railroaded and put in prison and how much the FBI and police lied and how important it is for this story to kind of come to the fore now.
That's right. And I will say, I was afraid I'd give it away, but people need to know. I mean, when you see Cleve and you see him getting arrested, I mean, what happens is that years later, when he is finally pardoned, he then becomes chair of African American Studies at the university, previously segregated, right, University of South Carolina, and is now the current president of Voorhees College in his hometown of Denmark, South Carolina. His son, Bakari Sellers, at 21 years old, became the youngest state senator, a state representative, in all of South Carolina's history.
Right.
And it's this amazing guy who introduced President Obama when he was down in South Carolina during the campaign.
I discovered him. He was featured in Gwen Ifill's book.
Oh, yes, he was, wasn't he? That's
yes.
Right.
Right. As one of the up-and-coming young African-American political figures. Bakari Sellers. There's a very moving point in that, in your film, when he speaks to a crowd, and tries to show the power of that moment by counting down the seconds that it took for these shots to be fired, and then could not maintain his composure.
It's amazing.
That was a pretty powerful. What was also very stunning to me was the half-hearted attempt at truth and reconciliation that you show in the film.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little piece in there with Fritz Hollings, who says, tells the guy in the audience that it's really irrelevant to talk about if these were white students who would have done something. That was pretty amazing.
Yes. Because, in fact, that's Jack Bass, the co-author with Jack Nelson of the seminal book on this called the Orangeburg Massacre. And when Jack Bass says, do you think that this would have been covered up if this had happened on, he didn't say all white, but basically all white, Clemson University. And when Fritz Hollings, you are right, when Fritz Hollings says, oh, come on now, might as well say the Citadel. And, of course, everybody thinks, uh-huh, same thing. You know. But, no, it is a wonderful scene. But we shot a lot of, you know, we started doing this, Northern Lights started doing this several years ago. When I came on full-time staff, it was 2001, and Dexter Cram, the founder and head of Northern Light Productions, because Northern Light has been around since 1982.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I come on board, he says, I got a project I think you'd be interested in. He doesn't think I know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, my goodness, Orangeburg, I just got some clippings from Cleve Sellers. And did it. So we're going through this, and I did not know Cleve that well at that point. But it's clearly a good story. But we shot on Northern Light's dime for at least 6 years. Before we got funding from ITVF and then from National Black Programming Consortium, both of which are funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. But before that happened, we got that funding in December of 2006. And I was so, I screamed. I ran into Bester's office. He was on the phone. I ran back. I did a sign, which is still sitting up on my bookshelf, that said, it says, ITVF approved. And so I ran back. He's off the phone, but I'm still holding the sign. We did high fives. We jumped up and down. I mean, it was like, finally, you know, after how many shoots in South Carolina, how much money has been spent on this, on Northern Lights, you know, we had no funding for this. And then luckily, ITBS understood it, and National Black Programming understood. And so we were able to do more filming. But that Citadel shot, there was a civil rights conference at the Citadel in 2003. And that's where you see that scene that you mentioned with Fritz Holling and then the lieutenant governor, West.
Right.
Yeah, it's a absolutely revealing film.
I think one of the things that was so nice, the way some of the contextual aspects of the film too, because it was a very sensitive job was done to kind of show the contradictions, but also the humanity, or the human feeling, I should say, on the parts of the white state troopers, and their conversations about this, and their being part of that moment. And being defined by that moment was really very clearly shown in the film.
Oh, I'm so glad you got that. Because, you know, I was prepared not to like them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Bester did those interviews, the two of those. And you come back and you look at them and you think, particularly the one who shot.
The corporal.
Lanier.
Right.
Lanier. The police, that's right, the officer who shot. You see that he knows, you know, and he's older. And it's just, it's hard. You know, you can tell that it's hard for him. And the same, but to a lesser extent, for the younger officer who, you know, looks older, but I mean was younger then, who did not shoot. But it's Lanier, I think, who really touches you. And you do. You see their humanity.
So it wasn't intended, but that was a consequence of this film.
I think so. And what's interesting is that I think people got more in touch with that with the massacre by talking about it. I know it was interesting. The current mayor of Orangeburg, who is an older white man, looks somewhat like the mayor who's in the archival footage.
Right. Right. Uh-huh.
Yeah. and so he was prepared not to like the film. Wanted to see a screening beforehand. And he sees it. And when we see him, he spoke at the 41st annual commemoration. I mean, they've had a commemoration every year for 41 years of this event, this tragedy. And so we went and we premiered the film on February 8th at the 41st annual commemoration. The mayor spoke, as did a prominent white minister who gave the invocation, and the editor, the white editor of the Orangeburg Daily newspaper, who's a very good person, too. But in any event, the mayor, the current mayor, apologized for Tuesday night, which is the night that the city officers, the Orangeburg officers, beat the students, and particularly the women, which is what really sets the students off.
At the bowling alley demonstration.
At the bowling alley demonstration 2 days before the massacre. And so they are trying to integrate, and the police just kind of go off, and they start beating the students. And what really makes the students mad, particularly the male students, is to see their female counterparts being beaten in this way. Well, the mayor, at this commemoration on February 8th, apologized for Tuesday night and says to us afterwards that it was his apology was as a result of having seen the film. Now, I will say, I'm thinking to myself, you didn't apologize Thursday night, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, shoot. You know, you could have just said, well, you know, it wasn't the city responsibility, but, you know, as a South Carolinian, I also apologize. I said this to Cleve Sellers, who was the one arrested, you know, who is still in South Carolina, of course, and he said to me laughingly, he says, boy, you Northerners, you don't even understand. He said, this was a 180-degree turn for this man. And I thought, okay, you know, and Jack Bass, also a Southerner, said the same thing. You know, this is a real turn for him. So it's okay. I'm wrong. Yeah.
Given that and you finished this film, and when you reflect on it now, the significance of this film for people to see at this moment.
Well, I think first of all it's the smaller universe, and that's in terms of the effect it's having in Orangeburg. I mean that it has really made created a vehicle through which they could talk about this, because it wasn't just the white community that wanted to paper it over. It was the black community, some of whom also believed that the students had shot and believed, well, yes, it was an overreaction by the police, but thought that there was some reason that the police had shot. Now, no, that was not true. And so there, a lot of it is the discussion that's going on there. And just, I mean, it was 700 people who were in that premiere who suddenly rose up in clumps and gave us a standing ovation. It was the families of the three who had been shot. It was the survivors and their families and a number of other community people. And I just broke out and cried, you know, on the way back to the podium. So it's within the community there is having one thing. But it's and one young woman who is a senior at South Carolina State who said, you know, I never really knew what happened. She said my family would talk about it, would refer to it, but it was almost like, you know, I would get little pieces. Nobody really explained what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
She said, this is the first time I understand what happened. And she lives in Orangeburg. But what it does nationally is to show what happens when you have such an unbridled abuse of power. I mean, in my own mind, I'm hoping people see what we did in Guantanamo, what we did, you know, it's all of that. What happens when you don't have any accounting for a clear abuse of power? And what happens when you see what people think they can do to people if they are the other? Because what Governor McNair decided was, these are not like the black students whom I negotiated with the year before. In 1967, he had helped them get rid of the president at South Carolina State, who was not very good.
Mm-hmm.
He had worked with them. But he now decides, this is black power time. Cleve Sellers is a friend of Stokely Carmichael who uttered black power. I can't, they are the other now. And so he doesn't think that he can talk to them. In fact, a lot of them are the same students. In fact, Cleve didn't even want to do the bowling alley. You know, so it is this the way that they misrepresent, because for the state administration, these are now the others. But what you also see is the role of young people, and that's crucial.
It is crucial, and I this is a marvelous documentary.
Thank you, Mark, and I know you're the voice of the community, so thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. And don't forget, you can see this documentary, Scar Justice, in May during the Film Festival, the Maryland Film Festival. Visit their website at md-filmfest.com for schedule and ticket information. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman at WEAA. We'd like to thank Nick Shostrom at Clean Cuts for his engineering here. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, and Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. And to hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.